The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Matthew B. Kelly, good day to you.
A good day to you, K. Quincy Parker. Yeah.
How, in the name of all that is decent and holy, are you?
Darn well. And yourself?
I am splendid. I am fabulous. I believe that I might just be, in fact, oh dear, dare I say this? I think I might be glorious. Having had some seconds to consider it, I am in fact glorious. I don't know if
check it out.
Our listeners have had the beautiful experience of being found in the position to declare one's self doing gloriously, but it is a truly spectacular feeling to be doing gloriously well. I feel like I have, I feel like I have only one small, one niggling piece of business to attend to, and that, of course, is my journey to show off my orange Speedos at the end of this summer.
Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go. Hold fast to dreams. Hold fast to dreams.
That is fine.
How is your knee?
My knee is good. Awesome. It is. I mean, it still has the occasional twinge, but things there have improved tremendously as well.
Excellent.
Yes. So, on this episode of the Sunday Scotch Society, once again, we are, I'm straying from our moniker into the world of whiskey from the Midwestern United States. We're going to the hills of Kentucky for some genuine bourbon whiskey that is handmade in the hills of Kentucky. It is 114 proof, and it is one of the sort of premier expressions of a very, very prestigious but lesser known distillery in the Kentucky Hills called Willett Distillery, or Willett Distillery. And Willett is one of those things that it's almost a calling card to prove that you're a real bourbon aficionado. You know, they're very, very, very quiet about their products. They're not as well known like as Maker's Mark or as Bullet, but if you are a true Kentucky bourbon aficionado, you know about Willett. And today I'm going to be sipping the Noah's Mill very limited expression, and it's one of my personal favorite bourbons that I've had in the last year or two, and I'm really excited about it. It has a pretty interesting history. Back in the day, it used to be one of those bourbons that had an age statement. They used to call it a 15-year-old bourbon, which would mean, now, I don't know if you remember this, but an age statement is determined by the age of the youngest whiskey in the batch, not the oldest. So a 15-year-old bourbon means that the youngest whiskey in it is 15 years old. And that is not the case with the current, you know, production of Noah's Mill. That fell by the wayside some time ago. But now they are using their own stock to create the blend that goes into creating the Noah's Mill bourbon. Like I say, you know, it's 114 proof, and the reputation is exquisite. My own personal recollection of the first time I tried it is very, very positive. So I'm looking forward to seeing what today's sip will bring for me. So that's what I'm doing. What about you?
I continue sacrilege. This time, however, by introducing the variety of wine into the repertoire. So I took a look at the available whiskeys down here on Freedom Island, and I was not really that moved to pick up a bottle, especially at those price points. So I'm taking a chance on a label that I have never tried before. Actually, it's the first time I've encountered it. Bread and Butter. Got a nice Cab Sav from 2022 here. And we're going to see how that goes.
I have many, many thoughts, but I will restrain myself until such time as you have given us your thoughts on the Bread and Butter Cab. So,
okay.
But boy, do I have thoughts. Yeah.
It sounds like this is going to be lively and provocative.
Well, in honor of the great late Darrell Miller, one of my heroes in the journalism profession, and also one of my heroes as a talk show host, I do not shy away from lively and provocative. And particularly with an election not far away from where we sit at this moment here in our country. You know, this year there's elections in Trinidad and Jamaica, Belize, Suriname, I believe, and I think there's one other election happening this year in the Caribbean. And for us, it's next year. So, well, we'll see if he goes, if he waits until next year to call the election. But we'll, you know, we will be sipping our scotch or bourbon or wine, in your case, and watching the proceedings with great interest, whether or not we can decide together about whether we'll comment or not, we'll see. But there it is. I'm trying to distract myself from the bread and butter, Matthew, but anyway. Anyhow. Woo! Okay. So this bottle of Noah's Mill is from batch 23-33. And it's aged in charred oak barrels, and it's bottled in Kentucky. This is the original small batch bourbon from Willett Distillery, and it's called Noah's Mill. It's way overproof. It's at 114.3%. And, ooh, man, the color is a deep caramel, and the nose, oh my goodness, Oh man, I can't wait for you to have a sip of this or have a go at this. The nose is really, really big. It's nutty. Maybe it's because I have them in mind, but I would say I get a almost a macadamia nut overtone. Of course, there's caramel and corn because, it's good bourbon. It's a little fruity on the nose. And you get a lot of that wood from the charred oak, And in honor of your traditional manner of dealing with the nose of these things, where you talk about what it brings to mind, what this brings to mind for me is, I don't know if you remember back in the day when you would actually go to the theater to watch a movie. And I am feeling that kind of nostalgia, but instead of popcorn, which there's almost a little bit of the popcorn, especially after you let it settle in the glass a bit. Instead of popcorn, like I said, I think it is the macadamia nut thing that is in my mind. And so I get the it brings to mind for me sitting in a movie theater with a bag of roasted macadamia nuts, and people around me are eating popcorn because I still have that corn, that corn sense. And maybe it's an old theater that has a lot of wooden elements, because I get that woody, almost dusty nature. Almost, yeah, it's like an old theater for me. And the main feeling that I get off the nose is nuts with a little bit of fruit and some sweetness. I am really looking forward to tasting this. Once again, just to
You should.
remind you, it's the Noah's Mill small batch bourbon from the Willett Distillery in the hills of Kentucky. And
All
so
right.
here we go with my first sip. Oh my goodness. All right. So the first thing I want to say is, it is 114 proof, but the burn of the overproof quality is not, it's the word that comes to mind is restrained. So the burn is there, but it does not feel outsized. It is not overly pronounced, which is weird because, like I say, it's 114 proof. But immediately after the burn, the first note that I have on my tongue is sweet caramel. And as I am letting it sit on my tongue, I get the nuttiness that is definite, and it is absolutely macadamia nuts, definitely. There's a little corn in there as well. I mean, it's bourbon, so you should definitely taste the corn. On the second sip, I'm getting a really a robust fruit, almost like almost like planted. Maybe breadfruit that's roasted in butter and has a little bit of salt on it. And the feel of it, it feels very, the last time we had a bourbon, the feel of it in the mouth was a little astringent and it was a little thin. But this is a voluptuous, almost, not almost, it is a voluptuous, inviting, almost creamy mouthfeel. It's really good. And that finish is very long. And sitting on the palate as I'm letting the finish develop, it's definitely the nuts, definitely the charred oak, with a little bit of the sweetness still there. Yeah. And in your reading about bourbon, it's my third sip now, just to let the flavors play some more. But in your reading about bourbon, I'm sure you've come across this phrase before, a Kentucky hug.
No, I have not.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, okay.
Describe the Kentucky hug.
You know this as the burn in the chest, but a Kentucky hug is the way they talk about that warm feeling that you get in the upper body, that you feel like, it's almost like you feel the bourbon going down into your chest and spreading into your lungs. They refer to that as the Kentucky hug.
Okay.
So there's definitely a nice warm Kentucky hug on the end of this here. I feel like we are in for a treat as our conversation and this tasting develops. But at this point in the game, the Noah's Mill small batch bourbon is sitting at a 4.5, maybe 4.6 out of 5, just from my first impressions. So as we have our conversation, I'll see how it develops. But just talking to you now, and letting the finish develop and letting it sit on my palate a little bit more, the nuttiness is definitely still there, but I'm almost, in addition to the salted nut, it's almost like a candied nut, like candy brittle, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like a peanut brittle type flavor. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. I have seen people talk about how, you know, when reviewing this, you know, the really sort of elitist bourbon drinkers long for the days of the 15-year-old age statement version. And they talk about something, maybe something ineffable that's sort of missing from the current issues. But I think that they are full of it, because this is almost the perfect Kentucky bourbon, as far as I'm concerned. So for our listeners, if you see a bottle of the Noah's Mill, I won't say where I got it from because I'm not doing any advertising, but it is available here in Nassau. If you see the bottle, buy that. Brace yourself, because it's overproof, but it is worth the sip for sure. For me, Matthew, this is definitely on the list. I don't even need to wait for the conversation to develop to tell you that. For me, this is on the list.
Yeah, well, I mean, that presents a huge difficulty. Because I don't know that you have the restraint required to let me taste it so that it could get on the list.
First of all, Matthew, you are not wrong.
This great whiskey is going to miss the list because by your stipulation, we must both agree.
You are not wrong. But when you return to New Providence from Freedom Island, I will find a bottle of Noah's Mill by hook or by crook. If I have to beat someone's head in, I will find a bottle of this for us to taste.
That is the dedication that I look for from you as a great host.
This is how we will ensure that our list is worth the paper it's not printed on. All right. It's your turn now. Tell me about this bread and butter, my friend.
Tell you what is bread and butter. Okay. Nose. So, first, I'm just going to say, at the price point that this is, which is about $25 here, so I expect it to be, I don't know, 20-ish in Nassau. Off to a not bad start. I'm not turned off by this. Deep fruit as a cab sav should give. Let's see. What does this remind me of? Getting a little bit of currant coming through. A little bit of a spice note. I would not say black pepper. I'm just going to let that linger. See if anything else comes up. No.
You are letting it linger.
Yes, sir. No big particulars. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to... This is not a lot for me to describe on the nose here. And, let me try a little trick here because I've been letting this air for a bit so that my sip is... It's not one of those overly fresh ones from the bottle. Oh, okay. There's some floral notes. Oh, yes, I'm liking that. I'm going to go in for a sip. That is interesting. Okay, so a little bit on the dry side, as you would expect, but there's this lingering sweetness, which is not overpowering. This is not a Le Mont Parot.
I'm sorry, those words are not allowed to be said on the Sunday Scotch side.
You're the editor, sir.
I'm saying to you, one cannot say the words Le Mont Parot on our show.
I'm saying you're the editor, and you've said it.
I'm not editing anything. I'm letting you know that I'm ashamed that you would
I'm mentioning it because when I stopped to pick this up, my ride picked up a bottle of said same unspeakable thing. And I held my tongue. I just said, Is that yours? He said, yeah. Man, that was the end of the discussion. So, there we go. This finish is long. And I quite enjoy that. And there's the... little bit of nuts. This is reasonably full-bodied, quote-unquote. But what I like to call a full body that I like, that is not too sweet, is chewy. And this is chewy enough for me. It's not flabby at all. It's a little bit crisp. I wouldn't call it bright by any means, obviously. Okay, on the palate, it's a little bit more like black pepper. But just a lot of currants. I have to say, dude, for the price, I'm not mad at this at all. I'm gonna split this with someone after the show, and this will be done this evening.
So
now let's hear all these negative comments.
It isn't so much negative comments. What it is is there is a a kind of wine drinker that, okay, it's the type of wine drinker that I was 35 to 40 seconds ago. A person who hears the name of a vineyard like or a wine producer like the Moth Perot and immediately turns their nose up in the air and says, oh, please, that is not good wine. The problem with that is that that in the case of Le Moth Perot, they've been around since 1981. They are in Bordeaux in France, and they produce excellent wine, excellent Bordeaux-type wine. What they sell here in the Bahamas is the absolute bottom of the barrel, because that seems to be what the palate of the typical Bahamian wine drinker enjoy.
They like sweet things.
They like sweet things. But it is entirely possible to buy an incredibly nice bottle of Le Moth Perot, good Bordeaux red wine. The same sort of snobbery is often attached to bread and butter. And I have friends who drink wine who think that bread and butter is trash, which is unfortunate because, you know, California is one of these sort of hotbeds of wines that are very widely discussed. There are some people who swear that they would only drink Napa Valley or only drink Sonoma Valley or only drink the coast or whatever the case may be. But this particular wine, the bread and butter Cabernet Sauvignon, is a very popular wine. And sometimes popular is almost it's almost a curse word when there are people who are interested in demonstrating their superiority involved, right? So I was very curious to hear what your thoughts were about this wine, because I have heard so many wine drinkers dismiss it out of hand just because it's a popular bottle of wine, as if somehow that lessens the quality of the drinking experience.
Well, I'm glad that I did not listen to them, because as you were speaking, a roasted buttery flavor developed from a sip as I was listening to you. I've gone from not mad about this wine to quite happy with this wine for $25.
In the U.S., generally it is it's very cheap. It's $14.
Yeah,
here, you know, I'm sure it costs twice that at least, right? But
25.
It's not that bad. Ooh. Yeah. And you buy it in a restaurant, of course, it's going to be $40 to $50 for the bottle, right? Maybe even $60 to $70 because, you know, quote unquote, they gotta do the restaurant thing, right? But every review that I have read by people who are not snobs, and are only interested in whether they enjoy the wine or not, every single review that I've read of the bread and butter Cabernet Sauvignon tells me it's a good wine. Literally everyone.
And this is different enough to some of my other favorites that I could put this on a rotation.
Yeah. I'm trying to find a bad review. And it is, let's see.
Is it the best wine? Should it cost out of the store $50? No. But
I look for a bad review, and the first review that comes up from 2023 is, it is definitely bold, slightly spicy, earthy, and flavorful. This is an excellent wine for the price and delivers a great blend of bold flavors. And literally, that is the... That's the first bad review that I found. Now, if I go on to Reddit, now, of course, you know, you go on to Reddit, that is You know, it is.
Well, actually.
Yeah, precisely. The first thing I see here is, it's a bit silly in my opinion. It's like wine with clown shoes on. Completely over the top, not going to age well, not to be taken too seriously. That's a wine snob, if I've ever heard one, right? I mean, come on. Wine with clown shoes on? Really? But, you know, it is what it is. So I'm very interested to hear how you feel like it develops over the course of the conversation.
Good.
I'm curious, Matthew, about whether or not you have heard of this this phenomenon called the silver economy.
Okay. I don't know what brings that up, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's something that I've been thinking about. I'm not sure what that laugh was all about, but
I shall enlighten you.
Yeah, sure.
But I'm please sure. Continue. But
for our listeners who may not be familiar, the silver economy is the economic system that serves the needs of older people, including production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services targeted at the older population. And the term is based on the idea of using the purchasing power of older people to drive economic growth, but also in the human rights space, in the last little while, people are sort of trying to turn economic, sort of the economic focus into a quality of life focus as well, which I find fascinating. And it's something that I've been paying attention to, because I've seen in other Caribbean countries governments sort of starting to focus on the older portion of their constituencies with specific programs aimed at trying to enhance the life experience of the people who would make up the quote-unquote silver economy. And it was interesting enough that I thought, you know, let me bring this up with Matthew and see what his experience and his thoughts might be. And let me tell you, my fourth sip of the Noah's Mill small batch bourbon from the hills of Kentucky, it's been sitting in the glass for a bit, so that overproof kind of ethanol, really high alcohol, has toned down, way down. And now it is just a symphony of nuttiness with a hint of corn and some sweet caramel and maybe a little bit of breadfruit, like I say. It's just playing. It's playing exquisite music in my taste buds right now. I love it. I'm loving the heck out of this.
I love that you love it.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but yeah. So the silver economy. What are your thoughts?
Well, what you do not know up to this point, and I'm really only privy right now to disclose this, is that this is indeed. The big project that Arrowlink is working on. We are an executing agency for a program coming out of the IDB lab to actually engage with the silver economy. And I'll talk about this more. You know, I won't dominate the show, but I'll talk about this more in the future. But that's what the laugh was about, is because we've been spending months on this and you just out of the blue sort of brought it up. So that was hilarious.
I could imagine. But yeah, I mean, it's a thing though. I mean, clearly if the IDB is focused on it, it is something that has garnered the attention and focus of the research and scholarship community in our region. But for a country
I could say two things really just broadly speaking about the silver economy. One is that we live in a time where there are a lot of setbacks in certain things, right? And on a sort of bumpy day-to-day scale, month-to-month scale, maybe even year-to-year, things could look kind of down depending on what you're talking about at any given point in time. And people lose sight of the spikiness of a trend line that is, despite the feeling of, oh my God, this is up and down, and mostly down is how it feels just because of the way human minds work, trending up. And the line that I'm talking about is caring about other people, human rights, getting people generally around the world in better positions. Can it be done better? Of course it can, right? But really, can we bemoan the fact that 100 years ago, we couldn't have a conversation around the silver economy? What the hell is that? 50 years before that, there are hardly any silver people around for there to have been a fledgling bit of that at all. So I just want to say, first of all, there's that. Our capacity and care has increased. The second thing is the demographics really are pushing in such a way that the culture, society, and politics has to address this, or there'll be even more of a problem than there would be if you just sort of let things riot. Because in a lot of countries, most around the world, and indeed, we are now below replacement population levels. And so a huge chunk of our overall population is going to be people 60 plus. That's just the way it is. We didn't have a lot of babies.
Yeah, but before you continue, you are using a lot of sort of coded language, and I want you to unpack some of that language just a bit. Like, say the last sentence that you said again, but say it with terms that are not specific to the work that you're doing for AuroLink.
Yeah, no, all I'm saying is that there is an increasing burden on society when people come out of the productive workforce and the society has to give them what is in the social contract, i.e. you don't leave old people by the side of the road just to die. Like, we have come to the point where we do care and we can take care of older people. Also, though, like you mentioned, older people, this is not in every economy, but in ones that have developed a middle class, so to speak, the people in this age range, even from, I would say, from 50, really have a huge chunk of disposable income that they whether you look at it as a nest egg or they just exited the prime of their productive capacity and therefore their income, there's a lot of money tied up there, right? But also, they need to make sure that that money can take care of them for the long haul. So it's not like, you know, you just, okay, I've retired, I got this huge nest egg, it's time for me to invest. That's not how it works. But at the same time, you can't just allow all of that capital to be sequestered out of a system that is used to having that capital. So there's that angle that you have to take care of. But you still have to take care of the fact that the reason that capital is being taken out is because people got to take care of themselves when they get older. So that's why I'm saying that the society, culture, and political environment have to respond to this. It's not if they don't, then things are going to be really bad, both for people in the silver range and for everyone else.
What I find fascinating, Matthew, is that it has become a matter of academic study and research and institutional study and research and even institutional action. Seemingly, and I'm only going to speak for the Bahamas, seemingly before it has become a matter of community action. One of the things that I have found fascinating over the years is the relationship between young Bahamians and their parents. In my father's generation and generations before, parents were cared for and considered once they exited the workforce, let's say, right? Or even before then, once a child had become a productive member of society and they were, you know, they reached a certain earning potential and they, not potential, a certain earning reality, and their life was stable and they were capable of supporting a family or whatever the case may be, the natural order seemed to be to look after your parents. But I don't think in modern Bahamian society that is still the case. I think parents have been cut loose as society has atomized and people have become so focused on themselves and their own needs that what is essentially an alienated generation of people are left to their own devices. And whatever that means in terms of outcomes, it seems that we generally are not, as a society, again, I'm only speaking for the Bahamas, we generally do not seem to give two hoots about the people who make up, quote unquote, the silver economy. They are invisible in our government policy. They are invisible in our religious and community expressions. I don't even think that the majority of people listening know what the Persis Rogers home is, much less have ever visited. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I find it interesting that AeroLink is working on this, but I think that it's a space where I think beyond conversation, I think we need drastic action in terms of trying to make a silver economy a reality. Yes, let's recognize that there is economic potential in this community. And perhaps through recognizing economic potential, we will, as a society, find a way to value these people.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's where, from my personal point of view, this is such a tricky thing, is that the primary
focus of silver economy I want to say this before you say what you're about to say. The primary focus of the silver economy, from my reading and from my interactions with people in the multilateral space, seems to be finding a way to allow older people to live a more independent life, right? Not so much looking after people in their old age, but enabling people who are older to live more full, independent, fulfilling lives. I get that. I absolutely get that. But it just seems to me that in a country like the Bahamas, there are some fundamental issues that we have to address even before we start talking about emancipating these older people to live these free, full, independent lives. That's the last thing I wanted to say. Go ahead.
I mean, to what you're saying, an ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure, but the other thing is, like, we were on a call with a fund that was actually spun up for this in the Latin America Caribbean region. And the thing that a lot of people are missing, like, they come into this sector and they've joined that particular fund's accelerator and they have great ideas, but a problem with a huge chunk of those people looking to address issues is that it's not economically scalable. And that work is good, right? Let's say you want to just empower people 60 plus to make sure that they know what they should be doing nutrition-wise, exercise-wise, etc. Let's say you want to go a step further and you want to enable programs for them to actually be able to do those things, right? The question is, what is the sustainability of that? And how do you create an economy that is efficient enough that it can actually sustain itself and grow and scale so that you are solving the problem in a way that doesn't depend on these bottlenecks and single points of failure, such as government funding. So that for me is the real sticky part of the issue. We could identify a bunch of things that we should and could do, but it's sort of like becoming prime minister or president, right? Anyone can, but not everyone can, if you get my
distinction. Yeah, right? I totally do.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think without being too capitalistic about it, you know, it's important that second word in the distinction, silver economy, that the economy must be designed in such a way that it's actually working towards what you're trying to achieve.
So in addition to thinking about it in economic terms, right? I mean, but let's we're rounding down the hour here. So,
oh man.
Yeah, I know. This is a thing that clearly is going to have to come up a couple of more times before we even get to really talking about this properly.
Yeah, this is all just preamble.
Yeah, let's consider this an introductory, you know, conversation. But the term silver economy is based on the purchasing power of older people, using that to drive growth. That is a concept that should fill not only the government agency and public sector with glee, but it should also fill private enterprise and capitalism with a fervent desire, because these are the people who have worked for 30, 40, 50 years. These are the people who have saved up six figures, seven figures in some cases. These are the people with real money to spend. And yet somehow they seem invisible in the economy, like the larger economy.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that as a broad stroke, but, you know, the data and how it breaks down is complicated. You know, like, what is the percentage of, in any given economy, what is the percentage of these people, right? What is the rate of increase? What is the percentage of those people that have a net worth between X and Y, versus A and B, right? What's the spread there? So I think they are reacting with a little bit of glee from a twisted sort of perspective, just knowing, politically speaking now, knowing your constituency and knowing that you have to cater to people who have a little bit more power, which is what these people are. They've been in their respective games for 30, 40 years. They've amassed capital for 30, 40 years. It's not like these people don't have any say.
Yeah, but
right. But there's a section of them that are doing terribly.
And I was just going to say inequality.
Way, yeah, right. Yeah, this is a microcosm of the broader economy and the issues of the disparities of incomes and, you know, what is the purpose of an economy? Because as you get closer to death, right, you care less and less about the shiny car and, you know, how much jewelry you may have had, right? And it just clarifies and crystallizes the question, why are we doing this? What is the point? What are we actually trying to achieve within the economy? Are we just trying to drive up GDP? Number go up? Is that the game?
Yeah. That's
too coarse a measure. So I think some real key insights will come out of looking at the silver economy and these people who are in the golden years, you know?
But purely as an economic construct, though, my only sort of caveat in terms of, again, speaking specifically in the context of the Bahamas, thinking about the silver economy is the gaping inequality, right? Between the gaping inequality between some people who have successfully navigated economic development and have significant capital and are proper targets for economic development, and the other people who have scrimped and saved and worked and scrapped their whole lives and spent all of their substance to empower their children or to empower other people rather than being able to amass the wealth that a silver economy theoretically should target. So I think that navigating that inequality is why I am interested in having this discussion with you in this forum, because I know that we as a country love to use sexy new buzzwords without real deep and serious consideration. And I think in this instance, when it starts to come up in our political discussion, I would like for people to be a little more discerning, I guess, in how we consider what we are going to do with that part of our population.
Well, I'll say this. We're at the stage where we're going to be having a lot of conversations with a lot of people, and that includes the corporate world. It includes government. And I'm going to bring, you know, keeping people's identities private, I'm going to bring a lot of what they express, as well as my own views, into this conversation as it develops over the year.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. All right. So you've had some time. It has had some time to sit on your palate and develop. And now you will give me the summation of your thoughts on the bread and butter Cabernet Sauvignon.
Not to be cheesy, but early last year, or perhaps late the year before, I sat down with my wife for a candlelight steak dinner that I had not made up to that point in 10 years with a beautiful butter sauce and a nice wine. And this just transports me back to a nice medium rare juicy steak in the candlelight. That's where I'm going to leave this bread and butter cab sav.
So you join the legions who believe that this is an excellent bottle of wine at the price point and an enjoyable drinking experience.
I am personally quite happy. Buttery on the palate as we speak.
All right. All right. Well, my Noah's Mill small batch bourbon. Again, the bottle that I am sipping is from batch 23-33. From the hills of Kentucky, from the Willette Distillery, one of the most storied bourbon distilleries, and very quiet, you know. Like I say, it's an insider's brand. And my sip of this is still, as I take my last sip for the show, it's sat in the glass. And like I say, that overproof ethanol thing just went away. And so on the palate now, it's just nutty. It's corn. It's breadfruit roasted in butter. It's so good. It's so good. I can't wait for you to taste this thing,
man. I can't wait either. But you know, something that I meant to mention is that for a 13.5 ABV, like, it doesn't show up at all. Now, you know, I know that's low when you're talking about whiskeys and whatever, but this is, you know, this is not
but a... for a wine, 13.5 is actually not weak. You know, this that's is... a pretty strong wine, yeah.
So...
I mean, the big, huge cabs are only 15% ABV. So,
yeah,
like a 13.5 ABV, that's some pretty heavy alcohol for a wine, yeah.
Yep, doesn't... It's only affecting body in a nice way, and it's not forward at all. It's good stuff, man. Yeah, but I look forward to this whiskey. I look forward to getting back to the whiskey routine, and I look forward to seeing you in person at some point, sir.
At some point, my brother. Enjoy Freedom Island. It was a pleasure to chat with you as usual. I expect this silver economy conversation to be a long one, and I'm looking forward to it, my friend.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Das Darovia, my brother.
Ciao.
I am going to share this bourbon with one of my favorite drinking partners just to get an objective response. Because for me, I can't wait for you to taste this shit, Matthew. It's incredible.
I honestly look forward to it. Even though bourbon is not my favorite, you spun a tail, macadamia nuts. That's not something to miss.
Yeah, yeah. We can see.
Well, I'm gonna go split this bottle with Iron.
Yeah, enjoy yourself then.
Okay.
Alrighty, bro. Take care.
Check it out.